Conference record has joined the conference.
Good afternoon. This is Mark Young, the programming co-chair of JCSA J Pro Network. Just a public service announcement that will begin in 4 minutes, our Professional Development Month webinar with Dr. Erica Brown. Again, for those that have just joined us, this is Mark Young, programming co-chair of JCSA J Pro Network. I'm actually joined here in the JCSA offices with June Gutterman, who is my wonderful programming co-chair for these webinars and our in-person programs. Just a reminder, now it's 1:58. We'll be starting in 2 minutes with our professional development webinar, Being a Multiplier, Growing People Through Language with Dr. Erica Brown. So we will start in 2 minutes. Thank you. Good afternoon. This is Mark Young, JCSA J Pro Network programming co-chair. I have 2 p.m. We're going to wait just another 30 seconds or so for people to sign on. We have a lot of people that have registered for our webinar, so we'll begin in about 30 seconds. Good afternoon. It is just after 2 o'clock on the JCSA JPro Network Professional Development Webinar. My name is Mark Young. As many of you have heard over the last 5 minutes, I am the programming co-chair of JCSA JPro Network, and we're very excited to welcome you all to our webinar this afternoon, Building the Multiplier, Growing People Through Language with Dr. Erica Brown. Just a logistic note as we start, we have many people that are signed on visually and audio, and many more of you that are just signed on audio. So when we get to the point where you can share questions with us, you can either send a chat on the chat portion of the webinar. I'm signed on as Brenda Geverts, who's the executive director of JCSA JPro Network. Or you can send an email to info@jcsana.org to submit your questions if you're on audio but still in front of a computer, and I'll share that with you online as well. As the Jewish Communal Service Association transitions to the JPro Network, we're pleased to continue our tradition of conference calls and webinars that bring knowledge and valuable skills to Jewish community professionals. March is Professional Development Month, and we're pleased to wrap up this valued resource with this program. We would like to thank the agencies and local groups that provide professional development to Jewish community professionals around North America. We're going to have wonderful learning with Dr. Erica Brown starting in a couple of minutes, and then you'll have the opportunity to share questions, and we'll take a few of them for Erica to address, and then have closing announcements before we end around 3 p.m. Before we do that, we'd like to have a public service announcement to put May 28th on your calendars, when JPro Network will host its annual program at UJA Federation of New York. This year's theme is Recalculating, Generating Professional Success. Registration will be up shortly, so please check back to our website. Also, be sure to check out our monthly e-news for more events in your area. Thank you to Dr. Erica Brown for presenting today. Dr. Erica Brown is a writer and educator and serves as the scholar in residence for the Jewish Federation of Greater Washington, and consults for the Jewish Agency and other Jewish nonprofits. She was formerly the director of the Jewish Leadership Institute. She's the author of many books, including Inspired Jewish Leadership, a National Jewish Book Award finalist, Spiritual Boredom, Confronting Scandal, and co-author of The Case for Jewish Peoplehood. Her latest book is In the Narrow Places, Daily Inspiration for the 3 Weeks. She was a Jerusalem Fellow, is a faculty member of the Wexner Foundation, an Avichai Fellow, winner of the Ted Farber Professional Excellence Award, and the recipient of the 2009 Covenant Award for her work in education. She has degrees from Yeshiva University, University of London, Harvard, and Baltimore Hebrew University. And she served as an adjunct professor at American University and George Washington University. We're really, truly lucky to have Erica with us this afternoon. And without further ado, I'm going to pass it to Erica for our learning today.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Brenda. I always enjoy working with JCSA and supporting the work that all of you do in the joint sacred work we do together. So I thought it was kind of funny that March was Professional Development Month, and it's also time of March Madness. So I thought we'd kind of go with that theme and develop it a little further and think a little bit about language and leadership, how we grow other people through language, and how we diminish other people through language, sort of taking some accountability and responsibility for the language that we use and the language that we expect others to use in working with us, both lay and professional, so that we can cultivate genuine and authentic partnerships that feel safe and also productive and fruitful. So what I'd like to do is turn us, towards the language of multiplication. And I'll ask Mark if he could show us our first slide, please. I want us to think of something negative that someone said about you a long time ago that diminished your sense of self-worth and future possibility. And what I find astounding is that every once in a while I'll speak to a group and someone will say, someone perhaps in their 50s or 60s, will comment on a negative thing a teacher said to them when they were very young, sometimes 5 or 6 or 10, and they've carried the burden of those words for a very long time, because those words were words that diminished them, that humiliated them. They may have been said in public or in private, but more importantly, those words limited them. They limited their scope of choices and the way that they saw themselves. So an art teacher who says to a young man, I don't think that's the way we should draw. or a piano teacher who says to a young girl, you know, this isn't the instrument for you. Or someone says, chemistry is really not your subject when you're in high school. And although you thought about a career in chemistry, just that one line, it kind of hit you in that big thud, that noise that we find on the pavement when something loud drops. And we hear that noise again and again, the reverberations of the negativity and the diminishment and the certain closure of possibility. And in the contrast is thinking of something positive, just to go back to our slide, something positive that someone said about you a long time ago that increased your sense of self-worth and future possibility. In terms of a compliment, an act of praise, or perhaps more importantly, an invitation or a suggestion. I think you'd be wonderful at that. Did you ever think of going into teaching? I think that science is your thing. Did you ever consider a career in medicine or bioengineering? So there are people who actually create possibilities for us, perhaps things we never thought of, because they attach our capabilities and our talents to some larger sense of future growth. And it grows us and it expands us. I'm not a tall person, so I always think about the people I'm around who make me feel larger than myself in terms of opening up windows and portals to a future that I may not have seen myself. And certainly I think in the Jewish professional world, because our field is small, we have to grow people all the time. As John Gardner writes in his book on leadership, that mentors should see themselves as farmers, as people who plant seeds and gently watch and guide, almost on a path together, the trajectory of those we care about. And that would be true for professionals and growing other professionals, and professionals and growing lay people who may not actually be competent volunteers yet, or may have a lot of good intention but lack some competencies and skills. So what are we doing to grow other people? And who's growing us? What words of possibility has someone shared with us that make us think differently about ourselves than we thought before? So for those of you, if you can think of something negative or think of something positive that you've been carrying with you for a long time, you know, drop a note to Mark, and we'll certainly share that and obviously share it anonymously, because I think it's important to cite illustrations, and I'm going to give you one on the positive side because I'm an optimist, and I like to, if I could see the world with positive rose-colored glasses, I always will. So I was teaching a group of teachers. There were more than 100 in the room. They were having a thank you lunch that was put on by their day school. And the head of music at the time raised his hand, and he said there were three words that I heard when I was a 19-year-old that kept me in music. I didn't feel that I was particularly talented. I was visiting Israel, he said. I was doing some composing, and I shared that with a young composer in Israel whom I admired. And he said these three words, "You must continue." And when I heard those words, it really grew my whole professional self. In other words, music was a hobby, but it wasn't yet a career path. But those words really grew his own sense of possibility. So, Mark, I'd like to ask you to go to the next slide, please. And I want us to think, now that we've been considering and reflecting on those who said things that grew us or diminished us, to ask as a person and as a professional, are you a diminisher or a multiplier? We tend to like to be around multipliers. Multipliers, and we're going to kind of casually think about that before we go into a formal definition. We think of multipliers as people who generally are expansive and generous with their compliments, with their praise, with their ideas. They may even be over-communicators. They're quite transparent. And they're interested in generating a lot of possibility. They might connect us to other people when they have a good thought for us. They may find jobs for us or tell us about new initiatives. In other words, their general posture in the world is that we live in an abundant and blessed place in the universe. And because of that abundance, there's this spillover effect, I like to think of it. And in the spillover effect, I'm not diminished in any way by growing you or creating possibilities for you. In fact, when I do that, I actually feel larger myself. I feel that the world is a more affirming place, a place that's more generative and thoughtful and sensitive, and a world that is based on kindness. And I think about a verse in Psalms that we read repeatedly, called Olam Chesed Yibaneh, that the world is built on kindness. What does that mean? Well, worlds are built out of the kindness that individuals do for each other, share for each other. I write a column, Weekly Jewish Wisdom, which you can subscribe to on ericabrown.com. And tomorrow's column is about the power of kindness, the sort of magical power that kindness has to transform a world that felt narrow and limiting and perhaps dark at times to a place that feels robust and open. And so when we think about multipliers, we think about people we like to be around. We like to be around people who make us feel good about ourselves. We like to be around people who can give us a compliment easily. Unfortunately, many of us also find ourselves around diminishers. Hopefully we're not working for diminishers, but we'll talk about that too. So when you're around a diminisher, it might be that they're exceptionally critical of you, that you can never quite get it right when you're around that person. I'm not going to talk about mothers-in-law on the call or people who have difficult relatives who kind of, they feel drained in their presence. But I did ask a question not only as a professional, but as a person, because very often our personal lives and our professional lives blend, certainly in Jewish communal service, and it's not always easy to separate those identities. And we like to think that if we're multipliers in one setting, that we're multipliers in another setting, and that when we're diminished in certain settings, that hopefully we can limit that, but that very often there's a spillover effect there also. So when we're considering who we like to be around and who we don't like to be around, we look seriously at the diminisher, what it's like to work for a diminisher. And that can be a very disempowering experience because diminishers often take credit and assign blame. They often can't find the good in what we do. We feel very self-conscious around them and perhaps become more judgmental of ourselves as a result of being judged by them. And so if I asked you to, and I love doing this because I find it amusing, I've asked classes in mysticism but also in Jewish communal life and leadership to give me the body language around the word light. So if you're speaking by the phone and you'd like a kinesthetic moment, I'll ask that of you. What does it feel like when I use the word light? And a lot of people will open their arms or they'll turn their faces up to the sun or they'll open their bodies in a more expansive way. Because when we use the word light, we tend to think of things that multiply us and make us more expansive. It's been a very hard winter here in Washington. I imagine that many of you on the call have experienced a similar winter snow just yesterday on the 25th of March. And there is a certain, when the sun isn't shining, when it gets dark early, when things are cold, we find ourselves narrowing ourselves. So when I say the word darkness, what does your body do? Very often, your head bows, your arms may constrict themselves, you may find yourself crossing your legs. In other words, you come in on yourself, you withdraw, and you make yourself smaller. It's interesting, I often have deaf students in my classes when we can have sign language interpretation, and I had a deaf student in one of my classes on Jewish mysticism. We talked about light and darkness and did some body language around it. And he talked about what happens when you're deaf and the power goes out. And he says, and you can't see and you can't hear. And he described that absolute darkness and isolation that he experiences. And the entire class was silent and held on to that silence even if when he had finished speaking because they were so impacted by his sense of being diminished in that moment. So bearing this in mind and looking at that slide, we all want to think of ourselves as multipliers, but we're not always multipliers. And perhaps we're multipliers in certain circumstances and with certain people where we find it easy to be expansive. And yet we find ourselves to be diminishers in other settings. We might be wonderful at growing employees, but come home and find fault with our children, or vice versa. So let's take that question, and Mark, if I can ask you to go to the next slide, please. So I wanted to bring your attention to an article that then became a book. The article appeared, I believe, originally in the Harvard Business Review, and it was called Multipliers by Liz Wiseman and Greg McCowan. And their book, How the Best Leaders Make Everyone Smarter, really identifies both diminisher and multiplier behaviors. And obviously, I'm only synopsizing the book and taking out some bullet points, so I invite you to think about to read the book and think about it further, and also to think a little bit about how you could begin using the language of diminishing and multiplying within your own professional lives, whether you're working with boards, whether you're developing a staff, whether you're working in HR. There's a lot of ways that this language, if we allowed it to enter into our lives, it kind of makes describing a situation or personality type or leadership style more concise. It gets to the point. It articulates what we're thinking. So diminisher behaviors, diminishers hoard resources and they underutilize talent. Diminishers create a tense environment that suppresses people's thinking and capability. Diminishers give directives that showcase how much they know and often how little you know. They make centralized, abrupt decisions that confuse the organization, and they drive results through their personal involvement. Excuse me. We have a word for that last one. It's called micromanaging. And micromanaging often is much more about that person's problem, the diminisher's problem, with trusting an employee or trusting a partner or trusting a volunteer than with the actual quality of the work. People get personally involved, too much so, often are saying, I don't trust that you know what you're doing, so I need to make sure that on every occasion you've done this and you've done that and CC me on an email and make sure that I know exactly what's going on. And that saps a person's autonomy and drive. Recently read a book in a series of small philosophical works put out by the School of Life. And the book was about the nature of work and what people look for philosophically in their work life. And one of the number one qualities people look for is autonomy, is the sense that they can shape and transform the work that they do, and that they're not always having to answer to someone else all the time. Now, obviously, there's a delicate balance between autonomy and authority, but people who are particularly authoritarian in their style often diminish the personal, their personal involvement often diminishes their employees. So I want to talk about one other aspect of this in a little greater depth, and that's making centralized, abrupt decisions that confuse the organization. So it's interesting to note why that would be considered a diminishing sort of behavior. And I'd like to I wish I could speak with all of you face to face and engage that in that question. What is it about a diminisher that makes them make centralized and abrupt decisions that confuse the organization? And I think that some of that has to do with a false sense of power, that if you believe you have power over people, that one of the ways you exert that power often is by making illogical or unpredictable decisions to see how much people will respond. I said jump. I want to know how high you're jumping. Well, this is a walk-only zone. Why should I jump here? And so that sense of confusion often contributes to the diminisher's sense of how much power he or she has over you. And that idea of underutilizing talent, where you feel you've got so much to contribute, but people just aren't asking a lot of you. They're not asking you to optimize and give you your full reckoning, your full content, your full competencies into a particular decision, project, or initiative. Mark, can I ask you to move ahead to the next slide, please? Okay, multipliers. So before we have multipliers, a few of you did write in, and I want to share one of them, that I was positively changed in college by the comments or suggestion that I apply for an honor society. Who, me? Yes, I got in. So that's wonderful. We're excited for you that you got in. But again, you might have thought, who am I? Why should I apply for an honor society? How would I get in? And the response, mi anochi, who am I, is actually great, because that means that you and Moses, whoever you are on the same level, because that's certainly the language that he used when he was chosen for his position, and we're going to look at that text in greater depth. So if you have more thoughts about about the experience of a negative word or a positive word shifting your own view of self, please send them in and we'll share them with everyone. Let's get to multiplier behaviors on our slide. So a multiplier, and I'm going to save the first one for last, creates an intense environment that requires people's best thinking and work. Defines an opportunity that causes people to stretch, drives sound decisions through rigorous debate, gives other people the ownership for results, and invests in their success. Now, we might have expected the last one. In fact, we might have expected that a multiplier's job is really to confirm and affirm everything that we're doing, sort of like giving us the stamp of approval or the gold sticker on our actions. Being raised in the self-esteem culture in which many of us have either raised our children or have been raised, we often think of ourselves as people who, being with a multiplier means someone who's always going to tell me how wonderful I am. I often cite this wonderful New Yorker cartoon that came out a few years ago of a child who comes home with a trophy larger than himself and says, "Look, Dad, we lost." So if you're thinking that that's what a multiplier does, I think these authors are going to turn that on its head, because what you find in that middle three bullet points is the idea of intensity, stretching, aspiration, debate. If I'm a multiplier, I'm not troubled by the fact that you're going to take me on and you're going to challenge my thinking and you're going to push me to where I haven't been before, because I don't expect that a multiplier is going to pat me on the back and say, "You're good where you are," because then you wouldn't be multiplying me. So the multiplier is saying, where you are right now, don't stay there. Let's go higher. Let's be more transcendent. Let's think bigger. What would you do if fear weren't a component part of the way that you think? And certainly Sheryl Sandberg has written about this extensively in Lean In, which I know has gotten lots of mixed reviews, but I encourage you to form your own opinions. I actually think it's a wonderful book. I think it's a wonderful book for both men and women who may feel that they diminish themselves, which I thought was one of her most helpful chapters, was writing about self-diminishment. What happens when you read a job description that would require you to stretch and multiply yourself, but what you say instead of, "I'll learn on the job," is, "I don't know enough to do this. This isn't for me. This is too high level for me." Now, obviously, you don't want to throw your hat in the ring for something that you're not qualified for, but how many of us hold ourselves back? We create our own glass ceiling. So in terms of the multiplier as giving us an opportunity, presenting opportunities that cause people to stretch, driving sound decisions through rigorous debate, pushing us to where we haven't been. And I want to draw attention to the first one that we didn't read together, attracts talented people and uses them at their highest point of contribution. That's hard to do. And it's hard to do something that I just wrote about, which hopefully will be in the New York Jewish Week next week, about the expression, Ein Navi Be'iro. We have an expression in Hebrew that there's no prophet in his town. In other words, people don't listen to the voice of wisdom that's right next to them. Now, of course, I'm not a believer in this, and we're not believers in this, because this is from the New Testament. It's not from the Old Testament. It's not from what we call the Hebrew Bible. This is an expression, and it does express a reality that we find, but often it's an excuse. Why shouldn't we get rid of dead wood in our office? Why shouldn't we hire the best people we can hire? Well, there just aren't good people out there. We can't, this person they're not working to task, and they're actually, their level of energy is draining others, but there aren't other good people there. Well, what the multiplier would say is, attract good people by using them at their highest point of contribution. If you use people well If you want to really inspire people to join your ranks, then be the kind of person who is noticing people's talent and taking that talent to the next level. I imagine that many of you on the call feel that in some way your talents aren't being fully acknowledged or recognized. In fact, you may have lots of gifts that no one in your office knows about. You may be a closet musician. You may be a wonderful athlete. You may be a great writer. And all of that lives somewhere else. It lives at home. It lives in your apartment. It lives in your mind. And yet it's something that preoccupies you. It's something that gives you pleasure and joy. And yet it doesn't have a place because we've become so specialized and so narrow that we don't actually share the fullness of ourselves and our workplace, where again, there could be a spillover effect from our talents to the work that we're doing, because perhaps the work we're doing isn't creative enough to match the creative way that our imaginations are working. So let's, Mark, if I could ask you to go on to the next slide, please. I want to actually prepare us a little bit for Passover. Now, I'm always afraid to say Passover a few weeks before Passover because now everyone's going to get jittery about cleaning. So I'm not doing it to get you jittery about cleaning, but I am doing it so that you can live out the aphorism of a rabbi, unfortunately, of blessed memory, Rabbi Getzel Ellenson, who said you should learn for Passover as much as you clean for Passover, which means you'll probably clean less and you'll probably learn more. So we have a custom in Jewish tradition that we study about a holiday 30 days before the holiday to really prepare ourselves and create anticipation. And of course, you walk into a supermarket and you see a box of Manischewitz matzah, and there's kind of a sense that the holiday is coming, but that the holiday is coming for material reasons rather than perhaps preparing ourselves spiritually. So I thought we would take a look at this text, and again, my gratitude to Emily and Mark for putting the slides together. We're going to be in Exodus 3, and this is a text that I know that many of you have seen, because if you didn't read it, you saw the movie or you saw variations of the movie. But I want to actually see if, in looking at the text now, we can multiply the text, not by diminishing it and saying, oh, I've seen it before, I'm dismissing it, but really looking for things that we haven't seen in it. So Moses was tending the flock of Yitro's father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the desert, and he came to Horeb, the mountain of God. So it must have been quite a scene, the mountain of God, and being somewhere in its periphery, in its proximity, walking around in the desert by yourself. So Moses is tending the flock of Yitro's father-in-law, and of course he's a shepherd because every good leader worth his or her salt, and I say her intentionally in the Bible, functioned as a shepherd. The shepherd, as some of you know, because I wrote about this in my book, that the shepherd was the MBA of Jewish communal life in the ancient world. If you were a shepherd, you were sensitive to the conditions around you. You looked ahead to make sure that the vulnerable were protected. And for that reason, you stood from behind. It was your leadership was making sure that everyone there were no strays, and that people were moving in the right direction. Because if as a shepherd you put yourself in front of everybody else, you turn around and no one would be behind you. So the idea of the shepherd is someone who can function alone because you can't talk to your sheep, but never really feel alone because you feel yourself in the presence of God, so that we have David as a shepherd who authors the Psalms. I mean, these very pastoral, beautiful images of the shepherd, but the shepherd also being able to be in places of peril and wander and not feel discombobulated as a result of it. So Moses is a shepherd, like all good Jewish leaders before him, and as he's leading his flock to the far side of the desert, meaning he's particularly isolated and alone, he sees an angel of God who appears to him in flames of fire from within a bush. And Moses saw that the bush was on fire and it didn't burn up. Now imagine that when you're alone in nature, you have time to perseverate on the natural world and see things and study them in ways that you might not have seen them before. But even though Moses was working at the time, he thought, I'll go over and I'll see this strange sight, why the bush doesn't burn up. And it seems to be somehow magnetizing. He's drawn in by this strange sight. Sometimes strange things repulse us or they mystify us, and therefore we move away from them because we can't understand them. I'll give you an example. I don't love magic shows. I find it irritating not being able to figure out how someone does something. So that kind of trick, because I know there's a trick involved, makes me frustrated. So, but instead of that, you could say, oh, well, it's wonderful. I appreciate the wonderment of it. And I want to introduce a term, if you don't know this term, by A.J. Heschel, rabbi, the scholar and rabbi and social activist A.J. Heschel, who coined the term radical amazement to describe the capacity that we have for wonder. And I want to hone in, drill in on that capacity, because I think that capacity also says something very powerful about the multiplier. The multiplier sees something of wonder and does not move on. He says, let me go over. Let me see this. Let me understand it. Why doesn't the bush burn up? And when God saw that he had gone over to look, God called him from within the bush. So before we continue, in the Hebrew it's rendered a little bit differently. It's really when God saw that he saw, meaning when God saw that Moses saw, because we have fewer words in Hebrew than we have in English for different verbs. We have only about 2,000 root words, shorashim. So this language, God saw that Moses saw. God was looking for a leader who had the capacity to see. And certainly he found that in Moses. As we know, Moses looked outside his window when he was in Pharaoh's house. He saw a taskmaster hitting a Jew, and he looked both ways, and he killed the taskmaster. He knew that looking was going to change him forever, but he didn't mind looking. In fact, Heschel, who wrote a book on the prophets, describes in his introduction what manner of man is the prophet, that the prophet has lopsided ears and eyes. His eyes are bigger, his ears are bigger, because he's prepared to hear and see things that other people choose to ignore. So he says he looks at things. Moses looks at things. In fact, when Moses dies in Deuteronomy 34, he says his strength was unabated and his eyes were undimmed. His eyesight, which was really at the heart and root of his leadership, that wasn't taken from him even when he passed away. It was almost as if he's fully sighted at the moment that he died. So God calls to him and says, Moses, Moses. And he says, Hineni, here I am. And then God, who's trying to create this moment of intimacy, says, don't come any closer. Take off your sandals, for the place you are standing on is holy ground. So acknowledge that where you are is somewhere extraordinary. Something extraordinary is happening here. You saw it. You recognized it. Now I want you to do something else to acknowledge it. I want you to take off your shoes. And he says, I'm the God of your father and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look. And God said, I've seen the misery of my people. Just like you saw something that you could not comprehend, I saw something that I couldn't comprehend. I saw, God says, the misery of my people in Egypt. And not only seeing, but again hearing. And I've heard them cry out because of their slave drivers. And I'm concerned about their suffering. And I've come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians, right, and take them into a land of good, into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey. So if you just look at that verse 8, you've got a great example of diminishing and multiplying in terms of its spatial sense. They're in a land of the Egyptians, right? And you, when you think about issues of servitude, of slavery, of forced labor, it creates that sense of diminishment. So now he says, you're in that diminished place, but I want to take you into a good and spacious place where we're just flowing with good things, with sweet things, with things that are nourishing and nurturing, like milk, like honey. So I want to take you to that place. And the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I've seen the way the Egyptians are pressing them. So now I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. You were the candidate, Moses, I was looking for. You are the person who notices when things are strange and different, and you act on what you see. So you're the ideal person to multiply my people, to take them out of the diminishing culture in which they exist. Mark, can I ask you to Yes, thank you. So now we're in Exodus 4. And Moses, now we're in 10:17, and certainly I invite you to read the intervening verses. Moses says to God, I've never been eloquent, not in the past, since you've spoken to your servant. I'm slow of speech and tongue. And it was, Moses gets this unbelievable invitation to do this fabulously large thing, and all he can see is what he cannot do. He is the diminisher in this text because he diminishes himself. And let's look at how he diminishes himself, because next to this huge mission, the idea that he might have a stutter or a stammer or not come up with the right language, he's not elegant or eloquent, seems so insignificant. But it speaks to Moses' sense of insecurity and also his understanding of what leadership requires. Leadership requires action. It's not about, you need to compel and you need to advocate, and I don't have any of those gifts. And so God says to him, who gave man his mouth? Who makes him deaf or mute? Who gives him sight or makes him blind? Is it not I? Now go and I'll speak and I'll teach you what to say. And Moses says, no, please send someone else to do it. And then God gets angry against Moses. So I want us to think about that anger for a second. God says, Moses, I gave you a mission, and I also created whatever speech impediment you've determined you have. But who creates all kinds of birth defects, all kinds of problems that we have? And that shouldn't get in the way, because there's always going to be something that gets in the way. Let's try to expand and see beyond the narrowness of the way in which you've diminished yourself. And finally, God gets angry at Moses, because despite all the things that God is prepared to do, Moses, to help Moses with this mission, Moses says, I can't do it. And so God says, what about your brother Aaron? I know he can speak well. He's already on his way to meet you, and his heart will be glad when he sees you. Now, God isn't giving the job to Aaron. He's giving a piece of the job to Aaron. Certainly, Moses is the protagonist of the book of Exodus. He's our main character, but Aaron is a significant minor character. And as I often say, when you could have picked the best PR, your God, you can pick the best PR firm in Egypt, why choose Aaron? Well, Aaron sweetens the pot for Moses because, as we all know, Moses was taken from his birth home at 3 months, and he was put down the Nile. This is a common theme in biblical leadership, that many of our Bible leaders were separated from parents at a young age or orphaned, as in the case of Esther, separated as in the case of Joseph, and the list goes on. So when Moses is thinking about this position and thinking about all the perils of it, he's not thinking about the fact that taking the mission will mean returning and reuniting with his family. Now, Martin Buber, the philosopher, has a wonderful book on Moses, and in his book on Moses, he highlights the fact that only someone who had suffered Moses' abandonment would have put up with us as a people for 40 years. And it was the desire to find home, to find belonging, was very, very profound for Moses. And the chance to be reunited with his brother was very poignant and touching. In fact, in all of the Moses narratives, Moses actually, there's no mention of happiness except for this verse, that Aaron is glad to meet you and his heart will be glad when he sees you. The word simcha there is used. You should speak to him now in Exodus 4:15 and put words in his mouth, and I'll help both of you speak and I'll teach you what to do. He will speak to the people for you, and it will be as if he were your mouth and as if you were God to him. But take this staff in your hand so you can perform miraculous signs with it. So God says, I'm going to give you Aaron, and I'm going to give you an amazing staff. And the staff, and I always say you can't be a good leader without a good staff. I'm going to give you this staff. That's where, I know you're muted, but you would all be laughing. But with this staff, there is going to be amazing actions that will be performed, and those actions will speak louder than words. And Moses knows that I'll be with you. This is the language of a multiplier, of someone who says, I hear why you're saying no, but what would it take to get you to yes? Because every way in which you're diminishing yourself, I will try to grow you. Now, if you remember, Moses says he's not a speaker. And there's been a lot of interpretations. I'm fond of an interpretation I saw recently by Rabbi David Wolpe, that when he says kaved peh, that I'm heavy of speech, what he means is not that he's a stutterer, but he speaks about heavy things, intense things, serious matters, and he doesn't have what it takes to be a politician, that kind of chatty, sort of banal conversation. That's not what he does. That's not the way that he thinks. But any way that you understand this limitation, I'm not a good speaker, I have a stutter, I can't find words. When you look at Exodus 15, which is what we will read, and if you're a Sephardic Jew, you may have the custom to actually, as some do, to go to the ocean, actually, in the recitation of Az Yashir, the Song of the Sea, of going to the sea and actually singing the Song of Moses. So I remember being in college, in a college literature class, and in my Norton anthology, there was chapter 15 of Exodus, Moses' Song of the Sea. And it made me laugh. And I thought, imagine if Moses could see this now. This person who said, I have no words, and now appears in an anthology of literature thousands of years later. So what happens when you multiply someone who diminishes himself? When you multiply someone who diminishes himself, basically what you're saying is, let me give you the tools to grow. And once you do that, you'll rise to it, and you yourself will fill the space, and you do things that you never thought were possible. And I think that's really the message professionally that I'm trying to share with you today, but also I think the strongest message of Passover, the idea that impossible things do happen in this world, impossibly good things happen in this world, like a small besieged people becomes an affluent, influential force for good in the world. Those things do happen. And in some way they happen despite the fact that we diminish ourselves, because in our lives, every once in a while, we meet a great multiplier, and that multiplier takes us to some place we haven't been before. I just want to take you into that one hugely diminishing moment of Exodus. Moses is standing in front of the sea, and there are 900 Egyptians behind him in iron chariots, and in front of him is the water. Now, there can be nothing that makes a leader more frightened than not seeing a way to advance and move forward. And at that moment, God says, take your staff, in other words, your staff, take your leadership, and extend it over the water, and the water opens. This idea of now's the time when things look bleak and you can't imagine any future, look within yourself, stretch your arm out beyond yourself, and create that which you thought was impossible. Because impossible things do happen, and often they happen because there are special people in our lives who grow us. And so I hope you have those special people, but more than I hope you have them, I hope you each become them, because our field needs the beautiful souls that grow others, that compliment others, that praise others, that don't feel that when they give love, when they give hope, when they give compassion, when they give skills to others, that it diminishes from themselves. Rather, it creates a more affirmative, compassionate, empathic world of grace. Thank you. Have a wonderful Passover, and I will turn you over to Mark.
Dr. Brown, thank you so much for your learning and for your wisdom with us. I'm going to ask if folks have questions to send them through chat message or to email info@jcsana.org. We do have about 15 minutes to provide some questions that Dr. Brown can address. And Erica, I was wondering if you can perhaps talk a little more about how we approach diminishers, perhaps a diminisher that is we report to. And is there, kind of based on what you taught us today, one action step that we can do to either alleviate that situation or help transform the diminisher that we report to into more of a multiplying relationship?
I think that's a great question, because you're saying, Erica, stop being so highfalutin and give us some practical advice. And I think that's fair. I often actually use a resource called Fierce Conversations by Susan Scott. which creates, I think, a very nice formula for managing difficult conversations and sometimes the difficult people we have to have them with. There's also the names of the authors escape me for a moment. They wrote Difficult Conversations, and then two of the three of them went on to write a book called Thanks for Your Feedback, which just came out, and I've just started reading it, and it's excellent. And I think those are good reference books for people who have to deal with diminishers and find a way to say, you know, hold on, let's catch that thought and do a redo. I think it is important to say, depending on the nature of the criticism, it is important to say, I'd just like to share with you what you just said to me, and I might regurgitate that and say, is there a different way of saying it? You know, without losing my temper, without feeling so jittery that I don't know how to finish a thought, is to have kind of the strength and the self-confidence to say, you know, that language isn't working with me. Is there another way you could say that I could hear it better? But with the emphasis on, I want to hear what you're saying. Sometimes if someone is diminishing you in a particular way, criticizing you, is there something that you could say that would make me feel good about this project right now? Which is a way of saying you're not making me feel good, but also really inviting someone to respond in a different way. And I think the power of invitation is really strong. Inviting people to grow, inviting people to shift the way they speak, inviting people to shift the way in which they convene. I will say also practically, and maybe it's a pet peeve, I think sometimes we hide behind our screens and we don't make eye contact with people. And when I say hide behind our screens, sometimes we have that temptation to have a difficult communication via email or a text, as opposed to saying, I need to have this conversation where I can see you and you might be able to see that I'm in pain, or that my body language is telling you something about my feelings. So I think sometimes that lack of the way that we hide ourselves, that lack of open-faced communication can get in the way.
We received a thank you very much. We also received a question just for you, if you could restate and perhaps expand a little bit on the definition of micromanagement that you gave in the framework of diminishers.
I don't know that I offered a definition, perhaps, but I guess if you can go back to the slide, is it something you can... Can you go back to the slide? Look how quick you are. Okay. So this idea of driving results through personal involvement, when your personal involvement minimizes the trust that you have in the people who are implementing the work, then you're a micromanager. If I have to stand on top of you and continuously say, did you do this and did you do that and can you CC me? And now sometimes when someone is new at a job, they need that time to initiate their to learn and to kind of master the learning curve. So I think that's different than when you've already found your feet and perhaps you're a veteran at what you do and you feel that someone nevertheless has to stand over you and give you guidance that either you don't need or you resent. And so I think it is important, rather than carrying the resentment and not actually saying what the problem is to say, I wish you could trust me more. Now, often someone will say, oh, of course I trust you. I just want to. And then I think sometimes it does pay to explore that on a deeper level. I actually am not experiencing your trust. I feel that one of the reasons that you ask me all the time about this is that you're not trusting what I'm doing. And sometimes we think people can mind read, and they can't. So unless we can say it in a respectful, thoughtful, but firm way, people don't know always what we're thinking.
Thank you. We received another question that I think relates a little bit to the God and Moses burning bush text that you taught us. Suggestions for supervising or mentoring people that are diminishers.
Yeah, I think a lot of that is if you can have written documentation of things that people say. I found that an effective technique is to read back to them what they actually said, and ask them how they might interpret that, because I think a lot of people don't realize how they sound or how their body language affects other people, when they roll their eyes in a meeting and other people notice, when they are dismissive or they're checking up on emails while someone else is speaking. I recently had this experience, and I have to say, I felt very diminished. I was presenting something, and the person right next to me was checking emails, and I felt like what that person is saying without saying it is, anything you're saying is not important, or I know it already, or I don't need to respect you. So I think that I think it's important to help people by holding a mirror up and saying, what would you do if someone did this to you? Because that's not going to create a collaborative team, and that's not going to create someone who's respected, well-respected by colleagues.
We had a couple of logistical questions come out as well. Do you happen to know, people wanted to know more about the radical amazement ideas of Abraham Joshua Heschel. Is there a specific book that he writes that in or other references that they should check out?
I believe it is in the book, Man is Not Alone. I believe that is where it's from. But I can certainly double check on that.
Thank you. And the other logistical question that we're happy to verify as well. People were excited about the quote "Olam Chesed Yibaneh," and we're curious about the specific source of that. I wasn't sure if it was Pirkei Avot, but one.
It's from the Book of Psalms. And it's been translated in a lot of different ways. The world is built on kindness, or rests on kindness. I don't love all the translations of it, and it's actually from I'm trying to Google so that I can get it. it's Psalm 89.
Thank you. Well, Erica, this has really been a wonderful opportunity to learn from you today. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, for your work with us, and thanks to everyone who joined us as well. We hope that when you go back into your professional workplaces and into your personal homes, and especially as we gear up for the next holiday, that we think about the words Erica shared, the multiplying behaviors and ideas that we can to implement and share to others. In addition to thanking all of you and engaging and learning with all of you, just wanted to reiterate that our next big program for JCSA J Pro Network is our annual program in New York, Wednesday, May 28th. The Save the Date is out, and the registration is going to be out in the next couple of weeks to and hopefully see many of you that are on the call in person in New York in a couple of months. A final note that this PowerPoint will be available, as well as an audio recording of Erica's session today. Thanks to all of you. We'll conclude our webinar. And again, thank you, Erica, for leading us in learning.
Thank you. Have a joyous Passover, and a Passover where you multiply others.
Indeed. Thank you. All right, take care, everybody. So.